And in that treacherous heat of deception, the troops who had claimed to be Muslims were about to manifest an ugly face of brutality against the Prophet's grandson.
It was not something that was unexpected. They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
Whereas Imam Hussein had to do the ultimate sacrifice, and he wasn't a submissive person. He wasn't a lamb going to the slaughter. There was no instance of going there just for the sake of being killed. Imam Hussein, in fact, we know as a fact, he fought up to the last drop of his blood.
And Hussein was not only to sacrifice his life, but he was to sacrifice whatever he had and all those who were dearest to him.
There's no way you should compromise with injustice, and that's the example. It's the example with practically all the imams, and certainly all the prophets. They displayed this courage. It's the inspiration that he gave everybody, and still does today. It's pretty clear. And so it's a benchmark. It's a he represents the ultimate sacrifice.
He would provide hope to all the oppressed today. And he would illustrate that numbers mean nothing if you're in the right. He would just mean hope. Numerical majority doesn't count when it comes to right and wrong.
Having the benefit of retrospect, we see how right Hussein was. I mean, he set the example in history. There is no doubt about it. That is magnificent. The example that Hussein set in the history, I think he did something that his grandfather, the Prophet, peace be on him, expected from him to do, to somehow setting the standard against someone like Yazid.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. the limelight.
The Afghan cities fall in rapid succession like men caught in enfilade fire. First Zarand, Kunduz a few days later, then Kandahar and Lashkargah. Next is Mazar-e-Sharif, and finally, the Taliban begin their move to swiftly and decisively take Kabul. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the New York Times and is written by Timothy Kudo. Timothy Kudo is a former U.S. Marine captain who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and is currently writing a novel about the war in Afghanistan. The piece is titled, I Was a Marine in Afghanistan, We Sacrificed Lives for a Lie. The Afghan cities fall in rapid succession like men caught in enfilade fire. First Zarand, Kunduz a few days later, then Kandahar and Lashkargah. Next is Mazar-e-Sharif, and finally, the Taliban begin their move to swiftly and decisively take Kabul. I watch this news, and at first I feel nothing. But at night I return once more to Afghanistan. There is a nightmare. The enemy and I are in each other's sights. Who will shoot first? I squeeze, but the trigger freezes. The Taliban fighter's finger curls. I wake. I have had this dream for 10 years, ever since returning from Afghanistan, but now it feels as though it has become real. Decades of war are dissolved in weeks. The Taliban advance with a speed that reminds me of the American conquest of Baghdad. There are other similarities. Taliban troops enter the gilded compounds of our corrupt Afghan allies and marvel at the evidence of years of American aid stolen by the former government leaders. During the day, my thoughts became preoccupied by the past. I hear a squad on the other end of the radio pinned down, a report about a Marine hit. The crack of fear in the sergeant's voice, clock ticking as blood pours from the 19-year-old's neck. We race to send the helicopter that will arrive too late. I see a report that the American embassy will destroy its American flags to deny the Taliban a propaganda victory. I think of the star-spangled banner that flew over my old patrol base, called Habib, Arabic for beloved. 5 men died under that flag, but for what? The hawks still circle and screech. The voices from the past 20 years who prodded us forward into battle return to the evening news to sell us on staying. It's not too late, the former generals, secretaries and ambassadors say. More troops can hold the line. Victory is just round the corner. But the speed of the Taliban's advance makes clear that this outcome was always inevitable. The enemy had no reason to negotiate and no reputation for restraint. The only question before President Joe Biden was how many American soldiers should die before it happened. But if leaving now was the right decision for America, it is a catastrophe for the Afghan people, whom we have betrayed. It's my old unit, 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, that is sent in to secure the airport in Kabul. I'm jealous. I would give anything to return right now, to give what last full measure remains. But that is impossible. Soon I learned that there is a fallback embassy at the airport, that our position is collapsing. That talk of weeks has turned to days and finally to hours, 36 of them, to evacuate the Americans who remain. All of this unfolds. There is much fanfare over the celebrities at Barack Obama's 60th birthday party, a celebration held as the war he expanded during his presidency ends in infamy in Afghanistan. But he's not alone. Our other commanders-in-chief also bear responsibility for what has occurred in Afghanistan, and there is no celebrating for those of us who ache each day wondering how we could have given the best parts of our lives to such a lie. The collapse has been sudden, our exit too ill-planned to evacuate the vulnerable Afghans who worked with us. We're desperate for the allied nations that went to war with us to take them in on our behalf. A few thousand here, a few thousand there. I look across the New York harbor to the Statue of Liberty and wonder why we are not lifting our own lamp for those abandoned by this war. Is our new colossus dead, or will she rise to repay her debt? In my mind, I see Huey helicopter teetering above the American embassy in Saigon. But rest assured, they say, the end of Afghanistan will be different from 1975. Still, our fathers and our grandfathers have fought and lost this battle before, and know better even if we did not. Will our own children suffer the same? There is more than enough blame to go around. After all, without those of us who volunteered, there'd be nobody to fight these wars. I long to appear before the young man I was, to slap his face and tell him to take a different course. You're going to die over there, I want to say. Not in body, but in spirit. But he's gone, and I will spend the rest of my life staring at his shadow. And finally, there are my fellow Americans, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, who voted repeatedly over 20 years for those presidents and members of Congress to mislead and mismanage us to defeat. This national shame is a millstone around all of our necks. Suddenly, reality snaps into focus. It's the entire nation of Afghanistan that is pinned down. I can hear her people screaming, and I will hear her death rattle before long. Here at home, the Manhattan skyline is clear. The Freedom Tower glistens, and our nation lumbers onward. This American tragedy has reached its final act. And now, we wait for the curtain to fall.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper, and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK, and has been coordinating solidarity, aid, and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of three-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larson himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at three, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, yeah. About the style of the filmmaking, because the Larson does use low-angle, steady-cam shots mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larson, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, they're given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden, and that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment.
Yeah,
it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child. But I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps, that we don't know where they are, what's happening?
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen, you know, but this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically, and so this is a different way of getting the message across. and poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet and very cute and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
Mm. And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea, and effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne workshops. Is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, for the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, but do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
An interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to a certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but... it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. It is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larsen used the child though on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world, and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think,
indeed,
to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people, you know. You can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people just like you and like us, going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different cultural culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is, if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. You see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, so home to 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They're not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness and pain and fear in the eyes of the adults. But they tried to protect the children from that, and you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how in the documentary there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port, and then they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience, or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
And Zita, would you agree with Maria's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I could hear them speaking, and you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about, he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. you know, they're embracing their children, they're sticking together, and this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the country?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there and it's going to be better for us and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate.
And she's three and she will... presumably integrate, but yeah, it's
perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed,
we'll
and it's scary times at the moment, and also after post-Brexit, I have to say. So
scary times indeed, and I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary, and that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The fall of Kabul has reopened divisions over immigration in European countries as government leaders brace themselves for the inevitable surge in refugees. We have prepared for you an article written by Angelo Giuffrida. The piece is titled Expected Afghan Influx Reopens Divisions Over Refugees in Europe. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Kabul has reopened divisions over immigration in European countries as government leaders brace themselves for an inevitable surge in refugees. Thousands of Afghans, among them the president, Ashraf Ghani, rushed to the airport in Kabul in an attempt to flee Afghanistan after the Taliban took control of the capital. Three people are reported to have died in the chaos at the airport. Leaders of Albania and Kosovo claimed they had accepted an American request to temporarily host political refugees seeking entry to the United States. It comes amid concerns that NATO members are not responding quickly enough to evacuate Afghan citizens who are in danger of reprisals from the Taliban. Albania, a country of 4.2 million people in southeastern Europe, is taking in hundreds of refugees. The country's Prime Minister, Edi Rama, said, "I'm devastated to see people left behind and want to give them at least the possibility to breathe again." He added, "We know what it's like to live under a dictatorship and what it's like to be a foreigner seeking shelter somewhere. It's about who we are. It's an honor and a duty to do this." Edi Rama said he could not understand how richer countries can turn their backs. He added, "This clashes with the values we all preach. Albania can't solve the problem, but we also don't want to be part of it." About 30,000 Afghan citizens have left the country each day for the past 10 days, the majority traveling to Iran or to Pakistan by land. Christopher Hain, a professor of law and immigration policy at Lewis University in Rome, Italy, said, "With the uncertainty and instability in Afghanistan, it is clear that there will be an exodus and Western countries need to act quickly." Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi said on Monday, 16th of August, that Italy is committed to protecting Afghan citizens who have collaborated with our mission, and the country is working with European partners for a solution to the crisis, which protects human rights, especially those of women. About 100 Italian nationals and embassy staff were evacuated from Kabul on Sunday night, arriving at Fiumicino Airport in Rome on Monday afternoon. There were also several Afghan citizens who had collaborated with Italian forces on board. An Afghan medic told the Italian press, "The Taliban is searching for people house to house. There are thousands whose lives are at risk." Luigi Di Maio, Italy's foreign minister, told Corriere della Sera on Sunday, 15th of August, "The priority was evacuating Italian citizens, but that we cannot think of abandoning the Afghan people after 20 years. Luciana Lamorghese, Italy's interior minister, said the country was planning to evacuate Afghan interpreters and medical staff who had assisted the Italian forces. With the far-right League being a key partner in Mario Draghi's broad coalition government, it remains to be seen if Italy will succeed in accepting more Afghan citizens. Matteo Salvini, the leader of the far-right party, who blocked migrant rescue ships during his 14-month stint as interior minister, tweeted, "In Kabul, after the cowardly flight of Western countries, the flag of Afghanistan militants returns. Terrorism, violence, fear, and illegal immigration are on the horizon." France's defense minister, Florence Parly, said on Monday the country would first evacuate its nationals and then Afghan colleagues from Kabul to a base in Dubai. The French defense minister, Florence Parly, said, We are planning to carry out the first rotation between now and the end of this Monday, 16th of August. Adding, the evacuees were French nationals who remained in Kabul, but also people under our protection. Major German newspapers and broadcasters have urged German Chancellor Angela Merkel to implement an emergency visa program to take in Afghan journalists who worked for them over the past 20 years. Deutsche Press Agentur DPA news agency said the lives of these freelance staff are now in acute danger. Austria said on Sunday, 15th of August, it would continue its policy of deporting rejected Afghan asylum seekers. The country was among six European Union states that recently insisted their right to expel failed Afghan asylum seekers should be maintained. Three of these countries, that is Denmark, Germany and the Netherlands, have since changed course, saying they would suspend deportations to Afghanistan. France has also suspended deportations of rejected Afghan asylum seekers. Austria's Interior Minister Karl Nehammer described banning deportations as a pull factor for illegal migration, which only fuels the inconsiderate and cynical business of smugglers and organized criminals. He added, "Those who need protection must receive it in a country that is closest to their country of origin. As Minister of the Interior, I am primarily responsible for the people living in Austria. Above all, this means protecting social peace and the welfare state over the long term." A survey by the Austrian newspaper Österreich showed a few Austrians supported their government's tough stance. European Union countries fear a repeat of 2015 and early 2016, where more than 1 million migrants, mostly from Syria, but also from Afghanistan and Iraq, arrived in Europe, sparking political turbulence within European member states and across the European bloc. The response was to make deals with Turkey and Libya to stem the flow of migrants. Heinz said, "But now they need to open their eyes and take responsibility," adding, "They need to quickly organize for Afghan citizens, including many women who collaborated with European countries in Afghanistan, to be airlifted out of the country as soon as possible."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
April 14, 2000. Imam Hussein's fight had two dimensions. One result was that Imam Hussein could defeat Yazid's government and take power away from those who oppressed the people. Another dimension was that if Imam Hussein could not, for whatever reason, achieve political and military victory, then he would not by words, rather by blood, by resisting oppression, by a language that history will never forget, make his narrative flow like a perpetual and non-interruptible stream in history. So as a result of some people's carelessness, the first goal was not achieved, but the second goal was accomplished. This is something that no power can take away from Imam Hussein. The power of going to the battlefield of martyrdom, sacrificing oneself and loved ones. The grand sacrifice that is so great that no matter how big the enemy is, it will appear small and unimportant before it. This bright sun will continue to emanate more light in the Muslim world, day after day, till his light encompasses the whole humanity.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
Today, Imam Hussein is known to the world more than he was 5 centuries, 10 centuries ago. Today, the situation is as such that when impartial intellectuals learn about the history of Islam and the story of Imam Hussein, they feel humble. Even for those who do not know anything about Islam, yet they recognize the notions of freedom, justice, dignity, elevation, and lofty human values. Imam Hussein is an invaluable role model in seeking liberty and justice, in rising up against vices and evils, as well as in fighting ignorance and humiliation of mankind. Today, wherever humanity has undergone some defeat, either political, military, or economic, the roots of it can be traced to ignorance or abasement. That is, either they do not have the knowledge and necessary understanding, or they understand but have sold themselves cheap. They have bought into abasement and have submitted to viciousness.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
Hours after the first plane carrying Italian nationals and diplomatic staff arrived in Rome from Kabul, top officials from Italy's government expressed their opinions about the Afghan crisis. Prime Minister Mario Draghi stressed the importance of preventing terrorism from spreading and protecting Afghan civilians and those who worked with the international community. Separately, the head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Luigi Di Maio, called on Western countries to seriously reflect on the mistakes made during the US-led occupation that went on in the landlocked Central Asian country for 20 years. Analysts and commentators have also been deeply critical of Washington and its allies.
Il tradimento.
Betrayal. That's all Afghans are left with. All of their expectations have been betrayed. The ethical failure comes even before the political one. After 10 years, the U.S. had finally killed bin Laden in 2011. Why did they stay in Afghanistan? To export democracy? In the interest of whom?
About 50,000 Italian soldiers were deployed to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, making Italy one of the countries most involved in the region, along with the United States, Turkey, Britain, and Germany.
It was on December 30, 2001, when the Italian military arrived in the area entrusted to them by the U.S., the quadrant of Herat, in the northwest of Afghanistan. The number of Italian soldiers killed since the beginning of the U.S. occupation is 53.
Also, about 700 Italian soldiers have remained seriously or permanently injured. The mistakes made by the U.S. in Afghanistan include handing government posts to sycophants or corrupt figures.
Italians were puzzled after U.S. President Joe Biden's recent statements, in which he admitted that the reason for staying in Afghanistan after Osama bin Laden's killing was not to rebuild the country, but to prevent other terrorist threats from arising there.
I have been very much disappointed by what both Biden and Blinken said about the drawdown. Biden's shift from nation building to limited counter-terrorist strikes in Afghanistan is very hypocritical. Many of us were there to rebuild a ravaged country. I hope European members will finally work towards creating a European Union military force. It's the only way we can have our say on international issues.
Italy's foreign ministry has said it is now working on a coordinated international initiative in Afghanistan to ensure humanitarian flights and make sure to tackle the emergency in an organized manner. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Herabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Okay,
Scores of Shia Muslims were injured and many more were arrested after government forces resorted to batons to file a mourning procession in the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir. The authorities had imposed strict restrictions and blocked several entry and exit points in Srinagar to prevent the traditional event held on the 8th Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar. Defying restrictions, hundreds of people, some holding flags, poured onto the streets at several places in the city center. However, police attacked them and fired several rounds of tear gas shells to disperse the mourners.
All our Indian people enjoy religious freedom, but when it comes to Kashmir, they adopt double standards. Peaceful mourners here are thrashed and arrested for raising Labaik Ya Hussein slogans.
The police also beat journalists covering the event. For the last three decades, the authorities have banned the traditional 8th Muharram and Ashura processions in the main city, citing security reasons. Despite repeated pleas by religious bodies over the years, the ban has not been lifted till date. This year, the authorities had initially hinted at lifting the ban, but later denied permission to take out the procession.
The government is hurting the religious sentiments of people here. We condemn it in the strongest term. Kashmiri people have made it very clear that they will not accept the ban on procession. Even if they are beaten and arrested, they will raise the flag of Imam Hussein.
The authorities say that the procession stoke anti-India sentiments and pose, quote, serious security threats. But the people here argue that if the authorities can allow the annual Hindu pilgrimage that attracts over 500,000 people, why not Muslim processions? Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to 1527 AD.
It's been 32 years and the status quo is intact. Every year, mourners defy restrictions and get thrashed in return. Religious bodies have strongly condemned the use of force against the peaceful mourners and termed the ban as a blatant breach of religious freedom and demanded its immediate withdrawal. Sedri Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban back in power 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Pariza, London.
Washington's so-called war on terror has failed in Afghanistan as the Taliban are now back after 20 years of fighting against the US-led forces. The militants entered Kabul with facing almost no resistance. Afghan ousted President Ashraf Ghani fled the country, saying he left